The headlines this hour: Iran says the United States is exploiting human rights as a political instrument, but the world public opinion is well aware of its dark human rights record. The British health minister says pay demands of nurses are unaffordable as thousands of nurses walk off the job amid a wave of strikes across the UK. And the French president calls on the European Union to take action against Washington's new subsidy policies, which the bloc fears could deepen economic woes in Europe. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Tehran slams the latest remarks by the U.S. National Security Advisor. Says Jake Sullivan's statement is another proof of Washington's interference in Iran's affairs and support for the recent riots under the guise of defending human rights, women, and prisoners. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says human rights gestures are only a political show by U.S. officials. Kanani referred to Washington's maximum pressure policy, as well as its unilateral and illegal sanctions against Iran over the past four decades. He said that such a policy shows U.S. statesmen have never heeded the consequences of those sanctions on the Iranian people. Kanani also censured Washington for exploiting human rights as a political instrument. He said the world public opinion is well aware of Washington's dark record regarding human rights, will not be deceived by his political stunts. On Wednesday, Sullivan welcomed the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women. He accused Tehran of, quote, systemic, that is, repression of women. Britons are feeling the pressure of the cost of living crisis. A survey says one in six people is worried about running out of food. Figures by the Office of National Statistics show that 23% of people also said that they were unable to keep their homes comfortably warm. Polling from Ipsos last week showed over 60% of the public think that Britain is heading in the wrong direction, indicating a widespread dissatisfaction among Britons. Demand for food banks in the UK has significantly gone up over the past decade. Workers keep going on strikes, calling for better pay in line with the soaring inflation. And staying with the developments in Britain, nurses begin a strike in their first ever national walkout amid a bitter dispute with the government over pay. An estimated 100,000 nurses are walking off the job at nearly 80 hospitals and health centers. The walkout will cancel thousands of non-urgent operations and tens of thousands of outpatient appointments. It is also scheduled to take place next Tuesday. The strike has no precedent in the British Nursing Union's 106-year history. Nurses want a 19% raise, arguing that they have suffered a decade of real-term cuts. The UK's health minister has also weighed in on the issue, saying the nurses' requests are, quote, unaffordable.
Well, we have an independent process that looks at these issues in the round, that looks at the pressure for many viewers faced with higher taxes, faced with cost of living pressures, and balances those with the needs of our NHS. Last year, we made a special case where nurses got an extra 3% when others in the public sector did not. But we've got to balance that against what is affordable to the wider economy. And asking for a 19% pay rise, way above what most viewers themselves are receiving, is not affordable given the many other economic pressures that we face.
Meanwhile, the government has so far refused to discuss payments, saying that it cannot afford to pay more than the 4-5% offered to nurses. The strike is part of a growing number of industrial actions in various sectors, including rail workers, ambulance drivers, and airport staff. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said the strike actions are, quote, unreasonable. Sunak has also labeled the Labour Party weak and not strong enough to stand up to the unions. Syed Purizar is our correspondent joining us from London to tell us more about the strikes and more. Well, Syed Purizar, at this point we know about the nurses' strike. If you can tell us about that first and tell us where that stands and where will it be going. I believe Tuesday is another day that they have set up for a strike, from what we understand.
That's correct, Kovac. But let me start by saying that Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, responded to the Prime Minister's retort, saying that what's happening now, as far as the strikes are concerned, the nurses' strike, is a badge of shame for the Conservative Party. This, of course, is happening 12 years of public sector freeze, pay freeze, imposed by the Conservative government over the past 12 years. Hence the situation we're in now, 19% they're asking for. An ONS report, a report by the Office for National Statistics, out this week saying that public sector workers, their pay rises are being outstripped by inflation, which, as you know, is in the double digits as we speak, expected to go even higher in the coming year. As for where the strikes are going, as you mentioned, there will be a second strike Tuesday next week, but it's one of many other strikes in the public sector that will be taking place almost every day of this month and into next month, starting with the railway workers, to baggage handlers at airports, to university professors that we also reported on over the past couple of weeks, to postal workers, and many others. The teachers in the education sectors are balloting as we speak, deciding on whether or not they're going to go on strike as well. So it's a very tough situation indeed. And what's happening also is that a report out recently saying that one-third of workers in the public sector are thinking of either quitting or are in the process of finding ways to a different job than the one they're in. And that of that number, it's 31% of nurses in the NHS. It's pretty significant. The people I talked to today, actually, on the picket lines outside St. Mary's Hospital in London, told me that this is not just about that. It's about staff shortages. And that is actually confirmed and supported by a parliamentary report, the Health and Social Care Committee, saying that this is the greatest workforce crisis in the history of the NHS and that it's not sustainable. So you can see why these people are out on the streets. So I heard from some other people saying that there are nurses out there are really struggling to get by, people who are having to rely on food banks.
Thank you very much. Said Pour is there from London. Thank you, Said. The head of the European Parliament vows wide-ranging reforms to its legislature amid a corruption scandal that has embroiled the European Union.
As of today, I am putting together a wide-ranging reform package to be ready in the new year. This will include a strengthening of the Parliament's whistleblower protection systems, a ban on all unofficial friendships groups, a review of the policing of our code of conduct rules, and a complete and in-depth look of how we interact with third countries.
Speaking to EU leaders at a summit in Brussels, Metsola said the scandal was an attack on European democracy carried out by, quote, people linked to autocratic governments. Last week, six people, including the EU Parliament's Vice President, Eva Kaili, were arrested following a probe into suspected graft. Belgian police conducted raids on the property of EU officials and seized at least 1.5 million euros in cash. This after Kaili recently returned from an official visit to Qatar. Prosecutors have said the Qatar is suspected of influencing the EU Parliament's decision-making through bribery. Doha denies the allegations, saying that it has been the target of an unprecedented smear campaign. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. France's president is asking the European Union to take action against Washington's new subsidy policies, which the bloc fears could deepen economic woes in the eurozone. Arriving at the EU summit in Brussels, Emmanuel Macron told reporters that the Union must simplify its own subsidy rules to respond to those of the U.S. He said that such a move is necessary in order to ensure fair competition among businesses. Washington has passed a new bill called the Inflation Reduction Act, which contains a package of subsidies for American-made electric vehicles and other green products. Europe says the act violates the World Trade Organization's rules, as it will entice companies to relocate to the U.S. This comes as an energy crunch has already taken a heavy toll on European industries, forcing them to slow production to save fuel. Jerome Hughes, a correspondent from Brussels, joins us. We also have John Ross, senior fellow at the Chungang Institute for Financial Studies, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Jerome Hughes. We understand that the French President Emmanuel Macron is now asking the EU to counter this, but we know that he was in the States just a week or so ago, wasn't he? And when he spoke to Biden, telling Biden about how this is unfair overall, generally speaking. So what happened? Wasn't that supposed to be taken up by the U.S.? Or are we looking at two different movements on this, one from the U.S., one from the EU?
Well, Covey, there's no doubt that this is protectionist on behalf of the United States, and it's very similar to the type of measures that we would see Donald Trump take when he was in office. And, of course, the EU is threatening reciprocal measures to try and protect its car industry in particular. But the reality is, I mean, it's been suggested this could potentially develop into an all-out trade war between the EU and the US. But if you speak to experts, they're saying this is never going to happen, especially now, because the EU as a whole, economically and on the energy front, has never been so vulnerable. It's really in a very shaky position. And at the moment, the reality is that although the energy that the United States can give to the EU in terms of liquefied natural gas, it's essential for the EU, but it's simply not enough. So what they're doing is, in terms of their potential energy suppliers, there's no way they can stand on any more feet. So the EU will not respond in any meaningful way, because in 2023, they need the United States LNG, even though it won't be enough. I have to say, and so really that the EU is in a very sort of vulnerable position in terms of what sort of actions it can take. And, you know, I mean, so the United States has all the cards effectively in terms of any disputes with the EU. And actually, you know, the United States, many analysts are saying it's the United States policies, it's NATO's policies that has the EU in a situation now where it's cut off effectively all of the energy from Russia to a great extent, or to the main extent. And now it's looking to places like Qatar. Charles Michel, on the way into the EU Leaders Summit today, he was asked about, you know, given this scandal that you mentioned earlier in the bulletin involving Qatar relating to the European Parliament, he was asked if this is going to affect all of these EU countries individually scrambling towards Qatar to look for Qatar's gas. And he said that he basically said we have to keep the lines of communication open with third countries. So he didn't even condemn this corruption, and he certainly didn't say that they're going to stop taking Qatar's gas. So they need Qatar, they need the United States, and then when you're talking about this Inflation Reduction Act, it's really just a tiny issue. The elephant in the room here for the EU is they will have no energy in 2023. There's no plan for energy. They're not going to agree today in relation to a price cap. Therefore, they cannot secure suppliers. This is going to be a really potentially disastrous for the EU in 2023. So they're not going to start standing on Washington's toes.
All right. Maybe you can break this down for us a little bit, John Ross, as to the severity of the situation, because we understand that a number of companies or factories, I should say, mostly ones that really use a lot of electricity, such as a metal factory or fertilizer factories, and we know a number of them, I'm looking here, that have already made plans to move or have moved to the U.S. already. But how badly this is affecting the EU as a whole, because the terminology that's being used is the EU is being deindustrialized. It's gone as far as even South Korea voicing concern. How bad is the situation?
Well, it's very serious, and it's an inevitable result of U.S. policy. I mean, the U.S. has now succeeded through its policy of expansion of NATO, of creating chaos in Europe. You have simultaneously the highest inflation for 40 years, looming economic recession, and a major war going on all at the same time. This is the inevitable result of the European government's refusal to say no to the US proposal to expand NATO. I mean, we wouldn't have had any of this if they'd said no. This is a very dangerous policy. It's against the interests of Russia, and it's not going to happen. Fortunately, in some other parts of the world, people are saying no. Xi Jinping, of course, just had a very successful summit with the Arab leaders. And in East Asia, despite the attempts of the US to create big crisis in places like the South China Sea, the other countries are not going along with it. In Europe, they have gone along with the US, and therefore they've been plunged into a very deep crisis. How deep it gets will depend upon whether they decide to stand up to the United States or not.
Well, here's the thing. From what we understand, it's the lower energy prices or rebates, whatever you want to call them, that amounts to lower energy prices that's enticing some of these factories to move into the U.S., from what I understand on this. Now, don't you think that the U.S. realized this, and is it something that they were waiting to see or was it really by design that they actually went through with this? Because when you take a look at the bigger picture, can't forget what the U.S. President Joe Biden said when it came to the gas supplies from Nord Stream, that we're going to make sure that that is not going to be functioning. Obviously, that contributes to this, doesn't it?
Yes, of course it does. That's one of the aims of the thing. I mean, the United States in the war in Ukraine has got two enemies. One is Russia, and the second one is Germany. And the United States has very successfully succeeded in creating the chaos in Germany. And the European governments created this problem themselves. There was a, if they had said no to U.S. expansion of NATO, there would have been no crisis of this type. Therefore, they've got themselves into this mess. Yes, of course the U.S. is going to do it. On the other hand, the U.S. is not actually going to industrialize very much. There are not many places, not many things going to relocate to the United States. What it's going to do is going to be a big boost to countries, for example, in East Asia, because they're much more competitive. I mean, the United States' internal market is so not the world's most rapidly expanded one that I don't think that there's going to be all that many places going to relocate to the US. What it is going to do is it's going to greatly damage Europe. Although it said European firms will be relocating production to Asia, not primarily to the US. There'll be a few go to the US, but it's not the main effect.
Thank you very much. And it's something that's going to help inflation go down in the US in the first place when you take a look at the other side of the coin. So, let's leave it there. We don't have any more time for this. Thank you, Jerome Hughes, our correspondent from Brussels. John Ross, thank you. Senior fellow at the Chungyang Institute for Financial Studies. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Whenever there is a show of solidarity with Palestine or blasting the Zionist regime's attacks against Palestinians in any corner in the world, Western regimes try to label it as anti-Semitism. Multiple U.S. cities have adopted a definition of anti-Semitism that silences Palestinians and expands surveillance. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truthout noted, in multiple cities across the U.S., the right-wing push for new laws to silence criticism of the Zionist regime for its human rights violations has reached a crescendo. As part of a growing international effort, the Zionist regime lobby groups have convinced local jurisdictions in several U.S. states to adopt the controversial and overbroad definition of anti-Semitism used by the International Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, which classifies virtually all expression in support of Palestinian rights as anti-Jewish. In California, the West Hollywood, Manhattan Beach, and Los Angeles City Councils each adopted the IHRA definition in the last 2 months. In Maryland, the Montgomery County Council did the same on November 2nd. The adoption of the IHRA definition comes amid recent high-profile incidents of anti-Semitism, namely Kanye West's incendiary comments about Jewish people, and former President Trump hosting outspoken white nationalists, Nick Fentes at his Mar-a-Lago estate just a week after announcing his 2024 run. Indeed, those in Montgomery County who voiced support for that definition reference West's hateful comments as an example of why it needed to be enshrined as policy. However, while purporting to combat anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition is primarily designed to shield the fabricated regime of Israel or the Zionist entity from criticism and ultimately from efforts towards BDS, that is boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. 7 of the IHRA definition's 11 contemporary examples of anti-Semitism focus on the Zionist regime, conflating the Israeli regime with Judaism as a whole. Among them are applying double standards to the Zionist regime, or claiming that Israel is a racist endeavor. Israeli lobby groups are weaponizing the IHRA definition to punish and threaten constitutionally protected speech, in particular that of Palestinians, describing the Zionist regime's brutal military rule and denial of Palestinian freedom. Even the lead drafter of the IHRA definition, Kenneth Stern, has argued against its use in legislation or policy, stating that it serves as an attack on academic freedom and free speech. When adopted by municipalities, the IHRA definition expands the scope of policing by giving law enforcement yet another tool and pretends to surveil communities who speak out for Palestinian rights. For instance, when West Hollywood officials adopted the IHRA definition, they claim that it serves as an important tool for law enforcement to identify, measure, monitor, and ultimately combat anti-Semitism, much like the post-9/11 counter-terror surveillance programs that devastated Muslim, Arab, Black, and South Asian immigrant communities in the name of national security. Will the IHRA definition measure public safety in terms of how many people that law enforcement can censor, surveil, and wrongfully criminalize? For decades, the fabricated regime of Israel, the Zionist entity, has faced increasing international condemnation for its racial discrimination and violent displacement of Palestinians. International watchdogs Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have both released reports accusing the Zionist regime of committing apartheid. Now, the IHRA definition is attempting to smear those criticisms themselves as racist. Black and brown activists challenging racist surveillance by the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, recognize the irony of this development. Akhil Gopal, a member of the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition based in Skid Row neighborhood of downtown Los Angeles, compares the logic of the IHRA definition to similar legislation that criminalizes predominantly Black communities for criticizing police violence. The IHRA definition mirrors Blue Lives Matter bills, which treat law enforcement as a marginalized class. It is part of an effort to embed pro-Israel advocates within legal anti-discrimination. civil rights, and hate crime infrastructures as a supposedly marginalized identity in order to weaponize the language of hate and extremism against Palestinians. Gopal told Truth Out, "When the IHRA definition is adopted by municipalities, it encourages law enforcement to surveil communities for supposed infractions. As a coalition, we have been organizing to expose how surveillance is not just an invasion of privacy, but an inherent part of criminalization." According to research attained by Stop LAPD Spying, at least one academic paper funded by the Department of Homeland Security has already suggested using the IHRA definition as an indicator of extremism in its widely denounced federal surveillance program, Countering Violent Extremism. Community organizations, civil liberties groups, and policy experts have fiercely opposed CVE since it was launched, citing the ways in which the program criminalizes constitutionally protected speech, religious practices, and political activism. The adoption of the definition by DHS would be a dangerous expansion and continuation of the war on terror's devastating impact on Muslim and immigrant communities across the U.S. Celine Cassini, a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, PYM, in Los Angeles, explains that she has worked with the Stopped LAPD Spying, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Vigilant Love, and other community organizations to oppose CVE, which racially profile communities and deputizes mental health providers, teachers, and other service providers to report community members to law enforcement under false pretenses of extremism. If the IHRA definition were to be incorporated into CVE, we can expect an increase of reports accusing pro-Palestine speech and activism as extremists, she said. This is not only an attempt to intimidate our communities and allies from building power through local organizing, but to also restrain free speech, consequently diminishing the health of our communities. Palestine Legal, a civil rights organization dedicated to providing legal support to the movement for Palestinian rights, has recently discovered through public records requests that pro-Israel organizations have sent PYM's flyers and materials to law enforcement, asking that Cassini's organization be put under police surveillance and shut down. The attempts to push the IHRA definition into law are just the latest example of the long-standing right-wing effort to redefine anti-Semitism as characterized primarily by criticism of the Zionist regime, rather than as an interconnected element of white supremacy and all forms of racial bigotry. Roughly half of the incidents of suppression Palestine Legal responds to each year include false accusations of anti-Semitism, totaling 1,017 incidents from 2014 to 2021. The adoption of the IHRA definition in multiple cities is not only dangerous, but also surprisingly regressive considering the broad array of institutions that have rejected it. Both Palestinian and Jewish human rights organizations, as well as major newspaper editorial boards, have opposed codifying the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism into law, including the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Palestine Legal, Jewish Voice for Peace, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. Cassini and Gopal's organizations continue to resist the IHRA definition and hope community opposition will prevent it from continuing to spread across the U.S. and beyond.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hidden Files.
Are you old enough to remember the emotional story about Iraqi soldiers stealing babies from incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital back in 1991? A Kuwaiti teenager introduces Nayira, said she had seen Iraqi soldiers take 312 infants out of their incubators and put them on the cold floor to die. Well, this story made headlines around the world and was repeated by political leaders, especially by U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who wanted to go to war against Iraq. Or perhaps you may remember the weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, that Iraq allegedly had In February 2003, then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, addressing the United Nations, claimed that Saddam Hussein was producing weapons of mass destruction. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence, Powell told the Security Council. And his address helped to win over the UN to wage war on Iraq in 2003. There's just one major problem with each of these stories, and that neither was true. But nevertheless, being false didn't stop these claims from causing havoc and destroying the lives of millions of people. Well, these are examples of what some may call an art, the art of propaganda. On this program, we will look at how propaganda was fine-tuned during World War I and why that matters to us today. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Over 100 years ago, in 1914, World War I broke out in Europe. Now, the Americans had declared neutrality, which was supported by both the president and the people. Edward Bernays was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he used his uncle's expertise in psychology with his own journalism background to create a way to make the unlikable more appealing. For example, when the American political elite had a change of heart and decided that the United States had to enter the war, they needed to figure out a way to convince a reluctant public of the need to get involved in that European war. Thus, the Committee on Public Information was formed, and its job was to change public opinion via mass persuasion. It was led by George Creel, and Bernays was a part of the group. There was a massive campaign of speeches, films, posters, etc., and it was extremely successful. CPI became the largest propaganda machine the world had ever seen up to that point, and its selling point was targeting the emotions of Americans without consideration of logic or even truth.
It was a plain publicity proposition, Creel recalled, a vast enterprise in salesmanship.
Creel was a pioneer, you might say, in the field of public relations. And then Wilson appoints him the head of something called the Committee on Public Information, which, not to put too fine a point on it, is essentially the U.S. government's agency for propaganda.
Creel saw his problem as transforming the American people into one white-hot mass of enthusiasm for the war. And the CPI went from a bureaucracy of one person to an army of about 100,000 people in the space of a couple of months.
The CPI mobilized movie stars for the Liberty Loan message. Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, all of the greatest stars of their day. Celebrity culture is just starting to emerge, and they can turn out crowds, and those crowds then become some of the biggest rallies that you see on the home front during the war.
Creel even found a way to push his message when the movie screens were dark.
In between every reel of film, there was a four-minute break when the projectionist had to change the reels. Someone at the CPI hit on the idea that this was a perfectly captive audience for the delivery of the war message.
Prominent members of the local community would stand up and deliver short patriotic speeches. They became known as the Four-Minute Men. And what began in movie theaters quickly spread to any venue where an audience assembled. In New York, Creel's volunteer army addressed 500,000 people each week. 10 men gave talks in Yiddish, 7 in Italian. President Wilson himself gave a four-minute speech.
These four-minute men would give a talk on some aspect of Americanism, why we are fighting, what are the principles we're fighting for.
The appearance of spontaneity masked a carefully scripted government message. These were no haphazard talks by nondescripts, Creel insisted, but the careful, studied, and rehearsed efforts of the best men in each community. Each speech aimed as a rifle is aimed, and driving to its mark with the precision of a bullet.
They were guided by a central authority, but always in the own words of the individual giving the speech. And he was usually a person who was known in the community. He was not saying, this is what the government says. He was saying, I'm an intelligent person, successful person. This is what I think. You should think this way, too.
So propaganda, or as it became known as, public relations, was such a success during that war that afterwards it became a permanent fixture of American society and other places to sell anything from products that people may not need or not have the money for to wars that people had no interest in being a part of. Well, that was the roots of modern propaganda, but it has been fine-tuned with great sophistication and effect, and has led to the current world of television and modern media. Much has been invested in trying to direct the human psyche, and nothing has been more effective than mass media, where it can demonize those seen as the enemy or immortalize those seen as friends. Well, to help me take a closer look at all of this, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program.
Dr. Tim Anderson is director of the Sydney-based Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He worked as a lecturer and senior lecturer at Australian universities for more than 30 years, teaching, researching, and publishing on human rights in development, customary land in Melanesia, small farming and food security, health systems and infectious disease, Cuban medical internationalism, self-determination and development, independent regional integration, and resistance to the wars of the 21st century. His most recent books are Land and Livelihoods in Papua New Guinea, 2015, The Dirty War on Syria, 2016, now published in 10 languages, Countering War on Propaganda of the Dirty War on Syria, 2017, Axis of Resistance Towards an Independent Middle East, 2019, and The Pandemic and the Independent Countries, 2020.
Oh, welcome to the program, Tim. I want to look at the concept of propaganda. I mean, the way it was used in the past, and also if we look at how it's used today.
We're looking at virtually a century of propaganda used in society generally, but in particular in relation to war, as you mentioned, the First World War and where Bernays' ideas were developed, I suppose. And there was a great effort to try and persuade the US public back then, 100 years ago, to get involved in what was essentially a European war between a reconfiguration of power between the old empires. And that had a role also in empowering the US voice, and the US, including the US Zionist voice, in British politics of the time, which of course became important because the British and the French were the colonial powers that took over the old Ottoman Empire and started to carve up the Levant, and particularly of course Palestine, and the Balfour Declaration was part of that. So the role of the US Zionists in that propaganda a century ago is an important one to remember. Now, if we look at the type of propaganda today, I believe it's far more sophisticated. I think that they are dealing with more highly educated populations. The systematic character of the propaganda and the messages, as Bernays said, emotional messages, more important than the actual facts. You know, for example, we look at a particular incident becomes much less important than the overall messaging that's going on around that particular incident. And that's very important today, I believe, in hybrid wars that are largely led by the liberal side of US imperialism, which likes to have proxy wars, it likes to have propaganda wars, economic wars, and so-called smart power, which is about getting other people to fight their wars and other people to finance their wars.
I mean, propaganda may not be based on truth. I want to look at how dangerous that is for us, especially today.
I said populations are more educated these days, not necessarily that they're more intelligent, but in some ways, very simple people with strong values sometimes understand these issues better than more highly educated populations. That's the sad reality. And those of us in Western cultures or English-speaking cultures, let's say, have to deal with as a huge challenge. Why is it that people swallow the weapons of mass destruction, lies, the you know, the Gaddafi feeding Viagra to his troops. They're using that same lie against the Russians at the moment. There are so many recycled fictions that are used to disarm a population and to get rid of the opposition to the latest war, the latest proxy war, for example, that it depends on techniques that are quite constant. And, of course, one part of it is the domination of the media, the control of the social media to a large extent, the insistence, the repeated nature of these lies, like, you know, the chemical weapons in Syria, repeated for year after year after year, until it comes to a point where people can't imagine that there wasn't some truth to this particular lie. But you've also got, I believe, on the part of Western audiences, a predisposition to want to believe that they are helping in some way, or they are on some human rights crusade when they back the latest economic war or military intervention against the country. It's an extraordinary thing, and I think it bothers me as an educator in a Western society that we have to really start studying the nature of stupidity in Western populations, because it's not all about information. It's also about people's emotional predisposition to believe these sorts of fictions about the character of war after war after war. I mean, thinking people have to raise some questions, but nevertheless, the propaganda machine relies on, it depends upon the fact that there are all these reinforcing messages and those questions don't really reach a very high level.
Well, another part of propaganda is demonizing the other and controlling information. For example, on certain platforms right now, we see how Press TV or RT are labeled as state-controlled media. But when it comes to VOA or BBC, that are government-funded, that is not the case. So already from the beginning, when someone looks at these alternative pages or networks, they'll be met with negative feelings or perspective. I mean, your take on all of this?
They put those tags in an extremely partisan way. Voice of America, of course, is completely funded by the US government, but same with the BBC. But they claim there's some difference between the BBC and Press TV, for example, in character. Of course, there isn't. I mean, there's other important mechanisms which you will find fairly readily through experimentation. The search engines, for example, if you search human rights and Iran, for example, you're going to find a huge number of sources from the US and from Britain and from their embedded NGOs, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and so on. But if it's Iran talking about human rights, you'll have to look very carefully to find that those references. The same with China. If you want to find China's report on human rights in the US and you search China, human rights US, you will find everything about the US saying human rights in China, and you'll look very hard to try and find what China is saying about human rights in the US. So there are a number of mechanisms there that are at play to deliberately curtail the flow of information, to prevent people from accessing a range of information and channeling it down to repetition of the same sources.
So, I mean, when there are so many controls put in place, what is key in order to discern truth from fiction in this massive world of propaganda?
I find very encouraging the fact that there are good media collaborations between Latin America and West Asia. And one of the examples is Almayadeen, for example, which is largely in Spanish and Arabic and now beginning in English. And that's really a collaboration between independent West Asian media and independent Latin American media. Then you have Hispan TV, which is a collaboration with the same with independent Latin American media, Iranian media in Spanish. Then we have Telesur itself, which is a continental network in Latin America, which is still a very powerful and universal source of information in Latin America. So the Russians also have some collaborations, the Chinese to a more limited extent now, but at least we're seeing with the division of the world into big blocks that you can go to large media organizations in China, in India, for example, if you want to get some independent sources of information about what's happening in Ukraine, for example. But the domination of the Anglo-Americans of media sources is something that's been there for a long time, and it's developed a great capacity, and it's a huge advantage that the Anglo-Americans have in the world of propaganda.
Well, I appreciate your insight into all of this. Thanks so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. Well, remember I mentioned the Kuwaiti girl at the top of the show who talked about what she had witnessed.
Thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again, we ask our friends in the media to respect the need to for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait. My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after an invasion, I volunteered at the Al Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying.
Well, just remember, no matter how emotional that appeal was, everything she said was a lie. Naira was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Her fake testimony played a role in the killing of 1.5 million Iraqis dying from starvation due to U.S. sanctions, and tens of thousands of Iraqis dying during the U.S. 1990s war Desert Storm. But no one ever held Naira, nor did they hold the United States accountable for this falsehood. Millions of Iraqis lost lives, and millions of disrupted lives were left behind. And a big part of it was all due to a lie. Propaganda can kill if packaged with the right covering. So be careful and stay aware. That brings us to the end of the show. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and I hope you will join myself and all the crew right here next week for Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.